this is one person, one project, one field, but actually use the forum to say, that's how we do things. You want names, okay, we'll give you a bunch of names, but the way we do things is that this field is used in 7 projects, because actually we rotate, because we share, because we... And basically what has been happening is that they got quite thrown by that, because we played their game without playing it. So the authorities are now, I think that they've now employed about 4 people full time just to deal with us. So, you know, we're good for the economy. It's like they keep employing people because we're just fighting on that front. And then, and so about, from what was at the time, about 90 dwellings included those who had been destroyed, of the 70 dwellings that were left, about 63 kind of went with the forms that were covered by the forms we signed. And what they did is that they came back in May to say the 6 that didn't sign got destroyed. So I only let you imagine what it meant to the movement, for people who felt totally abandoned, because it was really hard to defend. And it's like, so they kept trying, and they achieved that to a certain extent, to divide the movement. It's that, to really, you know, play the game of the good people who play the legal game, those who don't, and get destroyed. And so it has had quite serious consequences on the unity of the movement. But since that, we've been negotiating very, very fiercely to be able to manage the land as commons. And it's a very, very technical negotiations, because what they keep on trying to do is to say, no, you have to become conventional farmers. You need to get the funding from the state, you need to get into debt, you need to get, you know, you need to follow these, in French it's really funny, is that you need to follow the itinerary. That's what it's called. Follow the itinerary, follow the itinerary. And what we've been doing for all these months to say, yeah, yeah, sure, but our way. So this is the itinerary we're going to follow. And it's been that kind of fight. And one thing that was an important milestone is that on quite a lot of the land, we managed to actually have temporary leases being signed that run until the end of December, which meant that for all the land on which these temporary leases were signed, we could not be evicted anymore, which felt like a small thing for quite a lot of people, because it only runs until the end of December. But actually, when you've had 2,500 cops sent at you, it means that you have 6 months to be able to regroup and reorganize. And so it was not such a small thing. And it also meant that they officially acknowledged the fact that we were there and that we were legitimate. And that meant that politically, we had managed to assert something that was really strong. And on Friday, what is going to be the big decision is to see how these temporary leases are transformed, and how many of the people from us are going to be able to have a more stable way of staying. And how many of the... Because there is still a big fight with the farmers that got expropriated through the process of the airport and actually took the money, the expropriation fee. So they left their farms, got the expropriation fee, got compensated with the land that they had lost, that they had sold, which, you know, up to then seems fair enough. They had to give away some of their land. They got compensated. Quite a lot of them were still allowed to use some of the land that was either previously theirs or other on the ZAD, because there was no airport yet. And what is happening is that, so we call them the accumulators, And what's happening is that these accumulators are like, well, we already own there, so this land is legitimately ours. Where we're saying, actually, the land is legitimately going to those who actually fought for it. Is that you left, you sold, is that you never, ever, ever fought for this land to be protected. This is not legitimately yours. And that's where the big battle is happening. And it's on Friday that we're going to have some answers about these things. Sorry, that was a very long answer.
I have a lot of questions, but maybe because I already noticed one question over there, there are some people in the audience that want to ask something. Miriam?
Yeah.
I don't know if you But what is the confusion about, then?
I don't see any.
I can answer.
Okay.
I mean, the guys who made the film, that's what they chose to focus on. So, you know, they were there for two days and, you know, or 3 days, like most filmmakers, and that's what they, you know, focused on. We've always said, I mean, it's always been really diverse. So we have, you know, market gardens, we have wrap studios, we have screen printing spaces, we have forges for doing blacksmith, we have places for mechanics, car and mechanics, we have conservatories where you make canning and stuff like that, we have pirate radio station, we have free weekly newspaper, we have a library, so, you know, a space for films, etc. So there's as much culture as there is agriculture. The state, however, has said we can only do agriculture, and it's only agricultural projects that will be allowed to stay. Well, have they changed their mind now?
No.
That's what they said initially.
No, it's just that it's only the agricultural projects that would be dealt with legally first, and that all the rest would be left for later. So it's just that even those who actually put on their forms that they had a like craft project or a cultural project were not evicted, their dwellings were not destroyed, but the situation is being totally put on hold, is that we live in the house where there is the library and we have no idea what the legal status is. They've never, ever even looked at our case because they only wanted, because they knew that the massive fight would be with the farmers. So is that they took the farming issues first. And I think that the main thing is that one of the reasons why it's also presented mostly as a land issue is that you can't have creative activities if you have nowhere to do them. So I think that one of the things that has been a big fight is to be able to actually play their game, which was, okay, we'll only deal with the agricultural land, and it's that keep the land so that everybody can stay. And therefore, all the forms of life that take place. And I think that one of the things that has been immensely inspiring on the ZAD is also that these activities are not as split out or separated out as in the conventional world. Is that you have a lot of people who are, you know, one of the most, you know, one of our friends is a designer, a dancer, and she was for a long time one of the people who are looking after the cows. Is that so? You know, these things is that you don't have the farmers and then the librarians instead. These activities are actually quite mixed and fused.
Like that, I'm not a Marxist, but you know, some things that Marx said were interesting. Like Marx says, you know, in the morning, in the perfect, you know, in a post-revolutionary world, in the morning you go fishing, in the afternoon you go, I can't remember, you know, you cut your thing, and in the evening you disgust. I mean, that happens on the ZAD. Literally, you can be, in the morning you're you know, weeding acres and acres of beans, and then in the afternoon you're, you know, working on a text for a demonstration or an action, and then in the evening you may be learning how to do carpentry, you know. So there really is this incredible resistance to the expert culture and to separation, and yeah.
Okay, there was another question. Yeah.
Okay, I was wondering what happened to the land of the projects that got evicted in April then.
I mean, they're still there. Most
the land or the people?
Both. Well, it's, the land is still there. In one way, it's an amazing advert for low-impact dwelling because you have these incredible houses that were made from earth and wood and so on that had been there for 6 years, and they got destroyed by these huge bulldozers. And what you see is the marks of the bulldozers going in to destroy them. But where the house was, it's incredible already. The forest is growing back, and it's quite amazing. So in a way, as a, this strange thing around footprint, so the people who lived in them, no rebuilding is allowed, except we did rebuild, for those of you who have been to the Zad, one of the most beautiful cabins, because anyone who lives in a collective knows that making love can be an issue, a noise issue. So it's an architectural question, really. And to your comrades. So people built a cabin in the middle of a lake. So it's a cabin on a raft in the middle of the lake as a kind of love cabin. And that was destroyed by the police. In fact, they burned it down. And people just rebuilt it, and it's still there. So it's the only thing that's been rebuilt, and it's still there. All the others, every time someone rebuilt, they came back, and then they destroyed it. The people, some have left, many have left, some are around, there's a one big, big farm that has an unconditional welcome, so anyone can go and live there. It's called Lagré, so you can go there if you come from the street and you have four dogs and a heroin addiction, you're accepted, and you will live and work and eat and whatever, you hang out there. And that space is a very, very special space and has an incredible role in the Zad. And many of the people who were evicted from the East ended up living there. And they're there at the moment. But many left as well. Many of them on that side were more in an anarcho primitivist perspective as well. So they were coming from a kind of anti-agriculture perspective. I mean, that's the incredible thing about the Zad. You can have an anarcho-primitivist living next to a vegan, living next to a dairy farmer, living next to a communist who's using combine harvesters, living next to someone who refuses to use any electricity, living next to someone who's got a university degree and written books, living next to someone who's homeless and just come off the street. I mean, there was an incredible diversity. It's going to be a challenge to keep that diversity.
Hello, my name is Egbert. I have this question. What do you do to get support on the national political level for your way of life? Or do you do anything like this? And can you elaborate a little bit on this?
It's... Well, the thing is that struggle is a very, very old struggle. It's that the airport... as the film says, is that the airport was... planned and immediately resisted since the mid-60s. And it kind of, it went into dormancy when there was the oil shock, and is that actually the idea of building a second airport in the same city didn't seem like such a good idea. And then taken out of the boxes in the year 2000. And then when there was this call out from local inhabitants to ask people to come and squat to be able to defend the territory, that was already a massive opening. And there's been a very, very conscious strategy of trying to progressively build support. To be honest, one of the things that really helped was a massive strategic mistake by the state, which is an attempted wave of eviction in 2012, where they came with only 1,500 cops that time, destroyed 12 dwellings.
Many big farmhouses, stone farms.
And actually what they faced was a resistance that was not only super determined, but incredibly diverse. And they did not know how to deal with that, because literally you would have cops escorting big machinery turning up in a corner of a forest, and they did not know whether in the next corner they would face old people singing pacifist songs or naked people showing the vulnerability or black bloc people chucking stones at them. And it's just like, and that meant that actually that moment and that diversity of resistance meant that, in a nutshell, they had to withdraw. And basically, before the evictions of 2012, there was a handful of local support groups. And after, there were more than 200. Like, people had realized what was going on. And I think that it's also because there had been a lot of invisible groundwork from a lot of people that had done info tours and had, you know, it's like, and this is something that we've been carrying on doing during the years, is doing this kind of, you know, small public meetings in small villages and explaining what's happening and why. And I think that most of the info tours are, for instance, they're usually done with someone who has been squatting for maybe 2 or 3 or 4 years that might be living in the cabin that they themselves built with a farmer that has been living there for 25 years. And they are actually talking about the same struggle and talking about it from different perspectives. And I think that that diversity of the movement has touched a lot of people. And I think that it's been very, very good at articulating the necessity to fight against that kind of infrastructure, but not just as a kind of, no, we don't want that in our garden. It was just like, we don't want that, because, and from the very beginning, and I think that's really important to bear in mind, is that the struggle against the airport was never just, we don't want this in our garden. It was always a systemic struggle. It was like the farmers from the beginning were like, we don't want airport, full stop. We don't want these infrastructures. We want to be able to keep what we call in French the nourishing land. So I think that, you know, and but there's been a very thought through strategy of reaching out and doing this kind of work.
And it was a massively popular movement. I mean, when there were threats of evictions in 2016. So in January 2016, all the expropriation was finished, so they could come in and destroy everything to build the airport, the old farmers, the new squatters, everything. And in January, we had a mobilization. We had 40,000 people blocking the main bridge over Nantes with 500 tractors and 1,000 bicycles. Next February, we had 60,000 people blocking the main ring roads around the zone. I mean, it was a huge popular national movement. The Minister of Environment said, you know, if you try and build this airport, there will be a civil war in Notre-Dame-de-Lande. It was the most asked question in Parliament. When are you going to evict the ZAD? When are you going to evict the ZAD? So, you know, front page news all the time. It is a national movement. And it's embarrassing for the state, because actually it shows that you can have a popular movement that has a diversity of tactics. And that's, you know, most of the argument, especially around pacifist struggles, is that, you know, yeah, but if you have people who are, you know, violent, and if you do sabotage and stuff, you're never going to get popular support. Well, this struggle showed absolutely the opposite, actually, that it was a diversity of tactics. You know, it was really a diversity of tactics, and you could still have popular support, because we were right in the end. We had the moral argument.
Okay, maybe this is a good moment. We continue taking questions to ask the other guests to join us here, because the idea, frankly, was to kind of learn a little bit also from the experiences of the ZAD and to see whether we can use these teachings or experiences for the struggles that are taking place right here in Amsterdam, especially around the ADM and the Lutkemeerpolder. So, Alice, if you want to join us. I don't think there are enough chairs. Can we have two more? And hi, and Kees. And maybe we can then, in the meantime, take your question.
No, I just thought the question was actually, how did you try to affect politicians, politics, and political parties? Is that right? Wasn't that your question? Because I get the feeling that you didn't waste too much time on that, which is maybe a good advice.
So did you go to Any politicians, political parties, did you talk to them and did you try to enlist them in your struggle somehow?
Well, they were, because the movement was so diverse, is that there were a lot of local groups that would do this kind of thing. So if we say it's not necessarily super clear what the we means. So we as those who live on the ZAD, we never did that. But the a part of the movement, they definitely, I mean, if you look at what has been tried by the movement in its entirety, everything was tried. Everything. The legal grounds, the sabotage, the direct action, the lobbying, the, you know, awareness raising, the making films, the making books, the info tours, is that, I don't know, just... I can't think of one tactic that would exist that hadn't been tried. So I think that this is what is so interesting, is that it's almost impossible to say. It's like you as a movement, what did you? It's like there were always parts of the movement that would never do some things and other parts of the movement that would never do others. But I think that there was a common understanding. And it took a lot of infighting. Let's not be, you know, super idealistic, is that we argued a lot. And some people, it took a lot of shouting at each other. And people slamming doors and, you know, meetings being deserted and people coming back. And, you know, it was not that kind of super fluid. But there was this idea that actually the more we had these diversity of tactics, the stronger we were getting. With sometimes the impression that we were getting weaker, and this is also what, I mean, that's one of the lessons, is that don't give up even when you have the feeling that it's all done.
Yeah, one of the things that comes back all the time is this diversity of tactics. I think that is a pretty interesting and important topic that we maybe can use also when we are going to discuss the present situation around ADM, for example. Maybe high schoolmasters could say something about that. What actually is the present situation of ADM, and in what way do you think we could use some of the ideas that were developed in France?
Well, we have to be gone by first Christmas Day. We will not be evicted immediately, but they come and convince themselves whether we are gone or not. And then whether we are gone or not. And then they push the button to prepare the eviction. So I expect that in, I don't know, if we are still there, 6 weeks later or something. And now what's happening is that this is clear. This is two major court cases we've been fighting in the last 4 or 5 years. We lost them. And we made appeal, and so that's done. So if we want to survive, there's only a chance on the first chance is on a political level. Now, they offered us a piece of land under conditions which we, of which we said, this offer is not free zone worthy. It's for a period of 2 years. That's the most important thing. We don't like that. The conditions, other conditions, I don't want to dive into, but the period and the disrespect to us as a group who have been there for 21 years, that's unbelievable. So for us, we are still negotiating with the politics. We have a so-called left-wing council at the moment. We still have a very small belief that it might be possible to get something like a free zone, say if you have to move, to get something like a free zone which is less free as the place we have at the moment ourselves, but maybe more free than Ruigoord or more free than NDSM. If that's the case, we might consider to accept this. But at the moment, if I look at the state, current state of the politics, they are not bending far enough in our direction. So whether the compromise is going to be arranged, I have serious doubts of it. And probably in the next week or the week after, we're going to come out and for the first time reject hard in word and in the politics the proposal they made to us. And then they can make up their minds. We'll see. We probably stay negotiating, but then this is clear. Then the date is clear. Our position is clear. And we'll see what happens from there.
But now there are some interesting, well, not coincidences, but things that are kind of the same. Because when you came at the IDM, it was kind of, it was an old shipyard. There was not too much greenery. But you planted trees, as I understood. And now it's really like a green zone in the harbor area. So in that sense, it's contributing to everything that that we really need nowadays, more greenery. So it's in a way, it's completely idiotic to say, okay, you have to move, you go to another place, which is probably also less green than IDM, and they will destroy all the greenery and put some kind of new shipyard there and whatnot, you know. So that's one side of the, and the other side of the coin is, of course, that there are people living there. Children have been born there. It is actually just like the Zat. It's a kind of commons. And maybe it is possible to move such a thing. But I would say that is pretty dangerous because these structures are also very vulnerable. So it's not probably not a very good idea to move that. So these are two issues that are important in my view if we are talking about defending the IDM. The question of course is it feasible and is it is it really a good idea to try and defend it? What is your position on that? I mean, as it is right now, and not in the way of taking what you are being offered, even if it is less positive than what you have now, but really trying to stay there?
Well, to defend it and have a military siege, that's, I guess, that's impossible. There's another thing. I find it difficult when I look at Amsterdam and how it's developing, and when I look at the mentality of the current politicians and the council, when I look at the money which is involved at our piece of land, then, and the pressure which is on the land, on that small strategic piece of land in the harbor of Amsterdam, with an exceptional zoning plan destination. It has a double destination. It's a very important area for, well, the polluting industry in Amsterdam.
You mean the whole harbor area?
No, this especially, okay. Especially our terrain. It's one of the few terrains different from Ruigoort, where the sound and air restrictions are less.
Less
yes.
Severe. Yeah. Okay.
So this means you can have the most heavy industry on those 42 hectares. When I look at the pressure from the view of the politicians, they are in negotiations. It's impossible to change the mentality that they would change the zoning plan, have us there, protect the green, have an experiment, social experiment, or an alternative for capitalism or whatever. This is what our green left-wing council preaches. It's almost impossible to achieve that. So if we want to change that, we need an enormous pressure. And I even think international pressure. I'm meaning like people who can say to our mayor, hey, dear Femke, you are making a mistake here. Let's have a coffee and let's do this different. People with power, and these people, I don't see them. They are not there. So then it, for ADM, it's very simple. Of course we fight. Of course we defend. And the chance is very big that the offer we might get in 1 or 2 weeks or whatever, that it's not good enough, and then we won't move.
Okay. I was coming to you because there is another area which is under threat, which is the Lutkemeer polder, in which the organic farm of the Boterbloem is located. Now, one of the things that is probably also threatening is that they will play a classical divide and conquer policy. So offer one of these areas and save the other one, for example. That is a possibility, or make some kind of crazy compromise by which both of these areas are destroyed and somebody will be a little bit lucky and get something smaller in return. So, but maybe you should explain first a little bit what the situation is in Lutkemeerpolder right now and what the connection is or might be to IDM, because you wanted to say something about that, I think, or not?
I wanted to react on the strategy, okay. But we're talking about a 43 hectare area, agriculture area in the southwest of Amsterdam. It's all agricultural land. 11 hectare of it are used by the Boterbloem. They're organic farming, and the other lands are basically pretty much the same as you just explained. They are used by the historical farmers for nothing. They sold them, but they are using them until the exploitation is happening. What it is it's a company, it's called SADC, who wants to develop warehouses there. And this company is basically government. It means it's the city of Amsterdam, it's the city of Haarlemmermeer, right next door. It's the province and it's Schiphol, four of them who made this company. And there's a landowner, and the landowner is half city of Amsterdam and half this company. So we are fighting a project developer, but this project developer is basically acting as and it's also with communal money, because in the last they are since 30 their 30 year celebration last year, and in these times several times the city councils had to add money because they're not making enough money with selling all their property and selling all their warehouses. So already millions and millions of the city of Amsterdam have been thrown into this company in order to survive. So it's an interesting thing. What is the situation is that we lost all legal cases. It's the politics in March this year. They decided to, they made the city council just before elections put in a motie, which I don't know how it's called in English.
Motion.
A motion, okay. And yeah, it's a movement, no. And it's a unanimous motion saying that they want to search for possibilities to keep parts of the farm. Now, what is happening meanwhile is that a lot of people stood up and saying, like, we don't want to talk about the farm. We want to talk about this whole area because we think this area is an example for how the city should treat these kind of green areas. One, second, watching the climate, you know, you should look differently to agriculture. You should look differently to food production near the city, etc., etc. So while the city council is now preparing a proposal to the farm about these 11 hectares and how much they're going to give, in the meantime, lots of people stood up and are, you know, pressing the city council, like, hello, we want to talk about this whole area. I'm involved with the farm, but I'm also involved with Behoud Lutkemeer, which is the group doing this, and I'm really happy to hear you talk about diversity of tactics, because I really think that's also what's happening, and that's what should happen much more, and not so much that we should try and control this and see what is all happening, but there's a lot of people involved and a lot of people having a connection with this area or with this struggle or with climate or with agriculture who wants to show this case as an example for change, and I think that's what you should facilitate or support in any means necessary.
Okay, but if we come back to the issue of divide and conquer,
I don't see it because there are probably
two or even more ways to look at it, but one is, of course, that you say we are all fighting the same struggle, so we put ADM and Lutke Meerpolder, and by the way, there is another area more to the east, which is also under threat, Nieuwe Meer. So you can look at that whole zone as one green belt which stretches from Schiphol, from the airport to the Noordzee Canal, to the harbor area. And we have to protect that whole green belt, you know, not just one part of it, but the whole thing. Because that makes it much more difficult for anybody to play you out against ADM or against Nieuwe Meer or to against anybody else, you know. But of course, the other side of the coin may be that may be stupid, because then you run the risk of losing everything and not just one or two pieces of that green zone. So, what is your take on that?
Well, I don't agree that it's that they conquer, because I think I agree that we are in the same struggle, including the Nieuwe Meer, maybe. But it's not, I mean, it's not that they will come and say, like, okay, ADM can go on your spots, or, you know, I don't think that's going to happen. And if so, I mean, we are there, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's up to us to not have us being divided. It's not up to them.
Sure, sure. But that's not always that easy. Okay. Yeah. But, okay, maybe we can involve Case into this discussion, because, I mean, I said in the introduction that there have been quite a few successes recently, maybe not such big successes, but at least the fossil-free culture action here in Amsterdam at the Van Gogh Museum was a success, or a victory, because Shell was taken out as a sponsor of the Van Gogh Museum. Well, if you don't agree, you can say so. There was a huge action.
It's very infiltrated, so it's a bit difficult for me to talk about
that. Okay. But recently there was a huge action near Hambach, in the Hambacher Forest, just across the border from the Netherlands. A German judge said that the next year they cannot clear the wood, which is not a very big victory, but at least the wood will be still there for 1 year, and it gives you time to think about different actions and other tactics to save it. So there are some bright spots, but as I see it, you are from Code Rood. Code Rood is an organization that is behind some or maybe all of these actions, and they are really good in thinking out. Okay.
Yeah. Like.
It's good. Sorry.
Just to really briefly, I think there's too many people in the panel, so I think it's also okay that I don't take too much space. But anyway, Code Rood, in really short, is a collective or network of individuals with different political ideas from different backgrounds, organizing mass civil disobedience against fossil industry. We started out a year ago occupying the coal harbor, the second biggest coal harbor of Europe, opposite of ADM, with 350 people, and we shut it down for 1 day. And this year we went to Groningen to help the resistance against the gas extraction that's causing earthquakes in Groningen. So that's basically Code Rood. But I think what would be a bit more interesting to say is that Code Rood has been very much inspired by Ende Gelände, which is the big mass civil disobedience actions against lignite coal mining, with thousands of people entering the big open cast coal mines and shutting it down. And I think one case that you just mentioned is quite similar. It's a bit of a diversity of tactics, and that's the big victory of the Hambacher Forest last week. Mm-hmm. It's one of the biggest things in the climate movement, of this year, certainly. the victory over over the airport. And I think it also, like I think the way things, like the German social movements do things are quite different than how things happen in France, obviously. But there is also some similarities because, like I think, like the Hambacher Forest, it's like the cutting of the Hambacher, like the remaining Hambacher Forest has been postponed, and it's quite likely that it will actually remain forever now. And this is something that you could really not imagine 2 years ago. Especially, it's been occupied for six years, and when we were speaking with the people that were occupying it there, like 3 years ago, they were like burned out, without hope. And now, like last weekend, there were 50,000 people with a massive demonstration organized by all the major NGOs and civil society to support the Hambacher Forest. So it became completely mainstream in the last couple of months in Germany. And I think this would not happen. This would not happen with like one way of doing things. It's like a diversity of tactics. It's like it's people occupying in tree houses and like putting their bodies on the line and living alternative way of, yeah, like living a political life, like it happens at the ZAT and also at ADM in some way. And it's with people doing like mass, like doing like sabotage, burning down machinery of like the big energy company of Germany. And it's with people doing civil disobedience, like kind of symbolically having sort of disciplined, massive action against the coal infrastructure. And it's with NGOs doing like all the legal work and putting like a legal battle. And I think like not a single one of these different ways of doing it would have won it. Like without a single one of them, it would not have happened. Actually, I think the Hambacher Forest would have been gone by now. And I think that's like a good showcase of how diversity of tactics works.
Samantha, and I'm luckily a guest of ADM at the moment, after being there for many, many years, doing many diverse things, performance, gardening, rubbish. This is the rubbish crew for ADM. A question to you guys, because we've had lots of discussions about tactics, and I like diversity also. Hai is very good at his thing and representing a certain part of the group, and what I noticed that there's a difference between the living group and the movement, which is perhaps something for us to recognize and use to our advantage. And the other question is, how did you make it interesting to everyday people to support the ZAD? Because basically, it's a question that's popped up in Holland, because we're used to agriculture monoculture, but also we're defending against human monoculture. You know, that's what ADM is for me, anyway. I'm talking personally here. You know, and so it's the creation of diverse people in a diverse life. And it's very difficult in a trading country. I'm from England, but this is a trading country that's used to, you know, handling things. How did you get the message across that it's interesting for other people to be interested in an alternative way to, like, everyday people?
I can, you'll complete what I think that there was one of the things is that there was a very clear strategy of opening up. So, for instance, organizing days that we called the big open door days. So where we made it really public that the living collectives and the projects would welcome people that just came to see, and that meant that, and it took quite a bit of time and of convincing, because it's a weird thing to have people that come for the first time and sometimes come with, you know, a lot of preconceptions and kind of, and come and say, this is where I live and this is what we do is great and da da da. So it doesn't necessarily come easily to everyone. But I think that what was interesting is that when we actually organized these open doors day, the number of people who came, compared to the number of people who came when we said these, they are big collective work days. Come and work on the, you know, erecting of a barn, or come and fix this, is that. All of a sudden, calling it an open door day is just that. Don't come to do anything. Just come and see. Just come and chat. And it's that. And one of, for instance, one of the things that we did, and it's just one small thing. It's not the thing that, you know, it's that it's never one thing that works, but it's like we actually renovated the stables part of the house to make it an info space. So we made it really beautiful and made a big map and had loads of brochures and for at least a year made a commitment to be available when people turned up to explain what the history of the struggle was, to say, if you want to make yourself useful, you can go and garden here, you can go and do that there, and try to have that really open mind, and also to have that kind of approach in the media, for instance, and to really have this systemic thing of saying, what we're defending is so much more than this piece of land and our little houses. What we're defending is a certain vision of the future, and to try to have a balance between being quite humble in what we're saying and actually being quite grandiloquent. It's like, yes, we're defending the fucking future here. It's just like, and I think that for quite a lot of people, it was something to say, oh, well, they are people who are trying, and to be quite honest and saying, no, it's what we're doing is totally not perfect, but at least we're trying. At least we're doing something, we're doing things differently, and this is not, we're not just running. So I think that it's by opening up and making various days, because also the rest of the movement was also organizing a big event in the summer that started being, you know, a 300 people strong picnic and ended up with a 30,000 strong event with workshops and discussions. In six years, it went from 300 to 30,000. And I think that was, you know, and the info tours, and but I think that every time was really trying to talk from our perspective to a diversity of people and to make it every time relevant, I think.
I think food and France both start with F. And I think it's, you know, it's also a cultural thing. I mean, it's, you know, farmland, it's food land. You don't replace food land with an airport. It's really deeply because we like food in France and we eat food and it's, you know, it's a really key thing. We have banquets, you know, we have a banqueting hall and we have these big banquets which are free price, and you come and the guy is this like Falstaff figure of a cook running the inn and makes these huge banquets. And so that, you know, I think that conviviality that you find around food and banqueting is also a key cultural element that has made it much more open to I don't like the term, but, you know, more normal people. And we had a fuck of a lot of, you know, public relations work, you know, I'm going to use that word, but, I mean, to change the image of the Zad, because 5 years ago, the image of the Zad was punks with dogs and eco-terrorists. And the local politicians were saying it's more dangerous than Mosul in Iraq, you know, publicly. In the media, they were saying the Zad is more dangerous than Mosul in Iraq. So there was a lot of, you know, propaganda work to do to change that, you know, storytelling work to do to change that story. And one of the other ways we did it is actually by changing the image of precarity. I think that worked. So before, the image was, you know, just the cabins, and there's beautiful cabins, but it felt really alien to people. And when we started saying, well, actually, we're here for the long term, so we're going to build, using traditional techniques and traditional carpentry, we're going to build these huge barns that look like medieval barns, because, you know, these barns are going to last for 1,000 years at least. And that also, I think, changed things as well, to show that we were here to stay, and it wasn't just this kind of ephemeral kind of nomadic subculture, and I think that helped a lot.
Maybe just very quickly, it did not come without massive arguments. It was totally not consensual. I mean, there was a massive conflict on the zone about hiking paths. Like, you know, what at first for us seemed the most, you know, inoffensive thing is like some local groups wanted to open hiking paths, and for some people it felt like we were totally selling out the spirit of those ads, where we were making it into a bloody tourist zone. And so these things, just to say that these things are, I wouldn't want to present it as a super easy open strategy, as it sometimes it created a lot of tensions.
With their diverse living styles and everything, how did you get them all to agree to say yes to the open days together with the same focus? Did you choose one focus?
No, the open days were easy because basically the people who didn't want to have their places open, they were not.
And it's like,
it's 4,000 acres, it's huge, and it's just like, you know, people. But for some people, it was just like, they, you know, there would be texts in the weekly newspaper being like, they're turning us into a, you know, a fun fair. So it's, you know, they are turning us into a fun fair. So,
that's something else. But somebody would wanted to say something about that.
No, I have a question for Alice about the Lutkemeer Polder. I heard that you spoke with 15 people at the city council. I want to know, did you receive any positive response, and what will be your next steps?
It was only 10. One of the people spoke about the whole transactions, the ground transactions which are happening there, and there's a lot of corruption involved, and we also found out that the city council is dealing with somebody who's still in under investigation by the court. So this was, of course, a big thing in the city council, and we next week we will send them out a whole paper about what we found out, and we will have an expert meeting with some people from the city council. So In order of what do you think, what will happen, I hope this will at least delay the thing a little bit so we have more time. As what I think is the most important thing is to keep repeating to anyone, if there are politicians or journalists or just Amsterdam people or whoever, they're not going to build there. It's not going to happen. We're not going to have them. Let it happen first, and second, it is possible to change this. It is possible, because what worries me the most is that, say, 95 out of 100 people ask me, "Do you really think it will work?" And this is a very wrong perspective. It's very wrong to ask this question. It is going to happen because we are more people, and we have reasons, and we have very good arguments, and it's. Them, the only thing they have is money. Come on.
Yeah. Okay, are there any more questions in the audience or remarks?
Yes, well, I understand that you've explained from the Zat movement that you've been working on your own image building or rebuilding it. And I'm wondering, because the fact that it attracted so many people and farmers, and you were able to block the roads and the roundabouts, you're selling or promoting a vision or a state of mind, basically. It's not so much about the land, but the people who don't live at the Z that do support you, they feel empowered due to the state of mind to say no to the state. And I'm wondering what the Dutch section is doing about that, also like tactics on the image. So you know, like the narrative and so that's my question and a remark.
There is another question here. Maybe we can take that immediately.
Well, it's more like a direct response, because last year I was one of the spokespersons for Code the Road. So also in the preparation, we not just went to the harbor and did this thing there, but we also looked for contact with the national parliament. So there were actually also members of parliament who visited the action. And same for journalists. We put a lot of effort in advance to get them on our side. So, yeah, this is one part of the deal.
Yeah, I think that because, well, basically this is about public opinion or influencing public opinion. And as you say, I think that Code Rood has been pretty successful in doing that. So is there, are there any lessons for you, Hai, in this story?
I have one question. Do you think that the scale of the piece of land you have and the size of the group of people who is resisting there from the beginning, that really influenced the success you had? Your 10 times or maybe bigger than ADM, much more people involved, and that...
Not more people.
I don't know, I'm asking.
I mean, the size of the land did have an effect. So there was about 300 people living on the land. 90 at the end. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So there were 300 people living on the land at about 90 different places. But the police always said that they could evict the land, but they couldn't keep it because of the size, you know, because it's so huge. So they could evict everyone, but, you know, they couldn't build a fence around 4,000 acres. It's just too expensive and impossible to do. So that made a big difference, I think. There's a kind of literal material geographical difference.
But I think that what is interesting is that that's why I was intervening, is that there were 300 people living on the zone just before the evictions, but of the people who resisted throughout, so what we call the historics, is that it was just 11 families. So, and I think that the presence of these historic farmers made a massive difference in public opinion. It would have never been the same if it had been just squatters. And the fact that we could really reiterate is that the squatters are here because we were invited by people who live here. And I think that really, it was one thing that really made a big difference. It was just like, you know, when you have a farmer that says, I've been here 5 generations and now I'm a squatter. And it's that my cows are squatters, which has always worked with the journalists, is that it really made a big difference. It's just like, so I think that's in a way, that very small number of people, but that super symbolic dimension, I think was quite key.
Okay, well, if there aren't any other questions, I have just maybe one more question at the end, because I think it also has something to do with the way that you are organized. Because you didn't say too much about that, but you said that there were differences of opinion and sometimes they were pretty strong. So how do you deal with that? I mean, how are things being decided?
With difficulties? How do we deal with that? I don't know how to answer that. Is that we have loads of... we have a lot of meetings, and I think that... And I think that is also a struggle that has been unfolding over so many years, also means that bit by bit people start to understand that they really disagree with each other, but they can trust each other, because actually they disagree, but they always have people's back. And it's just like, and when, you know, there was really something, is that there were moments that were really key, is that when you see 500 tractors turning up on a bridge, is that it makes you way more patient when you have a farmer that says things that you find really irritating at the same and the next meeting. You're like, yeah, okay, but you turn up with your tractor. So I think that's I think that it's a mix of having a lot of large meetings, small groups, and it's like, and the way it worked for a long time, and that is being totally reshuffled by this new phase since the cancellation of the of the airport stack, but it was kind of, you know, they were what we called the different components. So the farmers would organize, you know, would have their own meetings, would organize, and the citizen groups would organize, have their own meetings, and come to general assemblies where they, which was always something that was complicated because on the ZAD, there was a refusal to be that kind of homogeneous component that would come up with one voice. So it was always this really quite complicated way, and there was, it was one of the stumbling blocks is that they kept, like, to the end, they kept asking, is that, what is the ZAD's opinion? It's just like, well, you know, they're about 17, you know, it's always been like that. So, but after a while, it was just like, you know,